soon as I got caught, I knew with all the evidence they got, and hey, we're fighting this one. It's over.
In the realm of human emotion, love knows no boundaries, and yet acceptance remains a distant dream for some people. In the 1990s, a gay couple sought refuge from mounting homophobia, leaving behind the confines of Colorado for the promises of Medford, Oregon. But their aspirations for a safe haven were shattered in 1995 when they mysteriously vanished. Fears began running rampant that they had become the victim of the very thing they were trying to escape. In the backdrop of the 1980s, fate intertwined the lives of Roxanne Ellis and Michelle Abdul within a doctor's office in Colorado. Roxanne, an obstetrical nurse and a devoted mother of two, found her heart drawn to Michelle, who had recently just joined the same workplace. As their friendship deepened, a spark ignited, blossoming into a profound love that transcended mere friendship. However, their romance unfolded amidst a troubling reality, a mounting tide of homophobia within Colorado. The growing influence of fundamentalist forces pushing Colorado's Anti-Gay Amendment 2 became too threatening for the couple, leading to genuine concerns for their safety. In 1990, they settled down in the city of Medford, Oregon, where they encountered conservatism's challenges in their new environment. Nevertheless, Roxanne and Michelle embraced their identity as proud gay women, and they refused to conceal their relationship. Fearlessly, they engaged at the forefront of the gay rights movement, making frequent appearances on television and in newspapers, particularly during campaigns to defeat statewide anti-gay rights measures. In particular, they fought against Measure 9, which was aimed to label homosexuality as abnormal and perverse, enforcing state and local governments to discourage it. The measure's defeat occurred with 57% voting against it statewide, but it passed in 21 of Oregon's counties. Roxanne and Michelle consistently advocated for gay rights in Oregon, actively participating in marches, writing letters, and delivering impactful speeches. Roxanne's daughter, Lori, described her mother and Michelle as the most openly out members of the community. Besides their efforts in the gay rights movement, they also collaborated with parents and friends of lesbians and gays, as well as a support group for individuals with AIDS. Jim Powell, one of their friends, commented, "I have AIDS and I almost died 3 times in the past year. And if not for those ladies, I wouldn't be here." When two of their friends were dying of AIDS in 1994, Roxanne and Michelle stood up to the plate to make their remaining months as easy as physically possible. They went to their homes each day, bringing home-cooked meals, changing bedpans, adjusting IVs, and working in the yard. Another friend, Brenda Brown, an esteemed gay activist, admired Roxanne and Michelle as role models for proudly living as active community members and being unapologetically gay. The primary source of animosity towards gay individuals in Oregon stemmed from a fundamentalist group called Oregon Citizens Action. They attributed the defeat of Measure 9 solely to the response of the gay community, insinuating that straight individuals would have preferred its passage. By 1995, 54-year-old Roxanne and 42-year-old Michelle began talking about other ways to support the gay community in Medford. They had plans to set up a centre for the community that would be education and service-oriented. In the very year that Measure 9 faced defeat, Roxanne embraced the joy of grandmotherhood when her daughter Lori welcomed a baby girl named Hannah into the world. The ties of family held a profound significance for both Roxanne and Michelle, influencing their decision to relocate to Medford, where their loved ones resided. On the weekends, Roxanne and Michelle doted on their granddaughter, allowing her to paint their toenails and taking her out on daily trips. To Hannah, Roxanne became grandma, and Michelle was lovingly known as Baba. Proudly wearing a t-shirt that proclaimed, "Hannah has two grandmas, she showcased the abundant love that surrounded her. In Medford, Roxanne and Michelle had found haven in an old craftsman-style house that they had purchased. Surrounded by their brood of cats and dogs, they embarked on the rewarding task of renovating their home. Those who knew the couple best said that they complemented each other perfectly. Michelle was the flame that burned, while Roxanne was the candle that supported her. They made an effort in the community, where people working in the shops and restaurants knew their names and faces, and always greeted them with a warm smile and a friendly hello. Lori recalled, they wanted people to know that they weren't perverts or monsters. As well as being romantic partners, Roxanne and Michelle were also business partners. They co-owned ESP Property Management, where they hired Roxanne's daughter, Lori, to work in the office. Additionally, Roxanne and Michelle were pillars of faith, actively engaged in the leadership of the First Methodist Church. Their commitment extended to serving on the church's board of trustees and assisting with communication. The pastor of the church, Reverend Michael Powell, stated, "We loved them because they were sisters in Christ." Their advocacy for LGBTQ+ rights found a powerful platform on television, where they fearlessly proclaimed that biblical scriptures did not condemn homosexuality. On the morning of the 4th of December 1995, Roxanne was diligently working when a man scheduled an appointment to view a rental property in northeast Medford. A few hours later, Roxanne's daughter Lori received a phone call from her mother notifying her of the need to run some errands, but she promised to call back later. Shortly after this conversation, Roxanne reached out to Michelle, requesting her assistance at the apartment. She said that her car battery had died and needed her to come and help her jumpstart it. Concerned about the delay, Lori kept an eye on the clock, expecting her mother and Michelle to return. However, as time ticked away, their anticipated arrival never materialized. Growing increasingly worried, Lori decided to visit the apartment complex where Roxanne and Michelle had been. Approaching the location, she spotted her mother's pickup truck driving away. Desperate to catch their attention, Lori tried to flag them down, but her efforts were in vain, and the truck continued to drive on. In the parking lot, she observed Michelle's car. Upon drawing closer to it, she made a distressing discovery. The vehicle was unlocked, and Michelle's purse lay unattended in plain view. The hours continued to trickle past, and Roxanne and Michelle never arrived back at the office and never made their way home. Lori couldn't reach either of them, and she promptly reported them missing to police. The search for Roxanne and Michelle kicked off with urgency as their friends rallied together, determined to bring them home safely. Posters, plastered in their thousands, displayed the faces of the missing women, spreading like wildfire throughout the region. Each poster carried vital details about their disappearance, including a description of the pair and the license plate number of their still-missing pickup truck. Meanwhile, Lori pleaded for information on television.
They're out there somewhere. If they're out there and they're safe, somebody to call and let us know. You know, we don't know where they are.
The first point of the investigation for the detectives was to try and find the man who had made the appointment to see the apartment. Typically, a record would have been made of the customer's name, but curiously, a record of this customer's name hadn't been made. Lori said to detectives that when her mother called her to say she was doing some shopping, she sounded subdued. She feared that somebody might have been holding her mother hostage, but for what reason? Amidst the uncertainty, hundreds of people gathered at the First United Methodist Church on the 6th of December, joining in prayer for Roxanne and Michelle's safe return. The service was led by Reverend Michael Powell, who stated, "I pray that we can look back and say, what an incredible experience. That was the scare of our lives. Thank God we are safe. That is our prayer." Whispers among the attendees revealed fears that the two women might have been targeted due to their sexuality and vocal activism. The specter of homophobia loomed overhead, especially after the recent Measure 9 campaign rejection, which had spurred an uptick in intolerance within Medford. One friend, Judy McGarvey, commented, "There is some fear of that. Some people have left the area because of fear of violence." At the end of the prayer, Roxanne and Michelle's loved ones lit candles and sang the hymn Amazing Grace. Roxanne and Michelle's friends weren't the only ones who were suspicious. Detectives also acknowledged the possibility that Roxanne and Michelle's activism and sexuality might have put them in harm's way. When detectives spoke with their friends, they learned that they had received some threats in the past. Police Sergeant Mike Moran commented, "We have no reason to discount those fears, and we're not. We want as a department not to work people up unnecessarily about an issue we have not proven yet, but we're taking it as a very viable option." Just the day after the service, Jerry Walker, an employee of TCI Cable, noticed a blue Toyota pickup truck parked behind an apartment building in southeast Medford. Jerry had seen the missing person posters, and he had memorized Roxanne's license plate number. As he drew closer to the vehicle, he recognized the license plate number immediately and promptly called police to report what he had found. Detectives quickly descended on the scene and approached the pickup truck. At first glance, it appeared as though there was nobody in the vehicle, but they soon observed blood seeping out from underneath it. The pickup truck's bed was covered by a camper shell, but as detectives drew closer and peered inside the windows of the bed, they spotted something that would stick with them forever. It was the bodies of Roxanne and Michelle. They had been bound hand and foot with tape, and both of them had been shot twice in the back of the head, execution style. It appeared as though they had both been placed in the back of the pickup truck, where they were both shot dead. Their autopsy showed that they had been shot close range with a small caliber handgun. There were no signs of torture or sexual assault. The shocking revelation that Roxanne and Michelle had fallen victims to a heinous murder sent shockwaves ripping throughout the entire community. The discovery of their lifeless bodies intensified the fears that a homophobic killer lurked among them, threatening further violence. Wendy Byrne, a local resident, expressed her disbelief, stating, "I didn't think something like that would happen here, but you never think something like that would happen where you live. Everyone here, straight as well as gay and lesbian, is pretty stressed out." Brenda Brown, a close friend of the couple, echoed the prevailing fear within the gay community. However, she was resolute in her stance, refusing to live in the shadow of terror. She declared, "I think there's an intense and extreme fear in the community, but we are rallying together and choosing courage." The missing person investigation quickly morphed into a murder investigation. Sergeant Mike Moran acknowledged the community's rightful concern, but withheld labelling the case as a hate crime for the time being. He said that they were exploring multiple possibilities, considering personal vendettas, business grievances, or even the chilling prospect of a random crime. With the investigation underway, detectives spoke with the residents at the apartment complex, where Roxanne had shown an apartment to the potential renter. The man who had made the appointment still hadn't presented himself to detectives, and a theory began to formulate that he was the killer. According to some residents, they had seen a man several times in the area of the apartment complex. He was believed to be driving a late model sedan with California license plates. According to residents at the apartment complex where Roxanne and Michelle's bodies were found, they too had seen a man driving the same vehicle. This man was described as a grey-haired man with wire-rimmed glasses. In an effort to trace him, detectives blanketed both Oregon and California with composite sketches of the man. Detectives theorized that the man who had made the appointment to view the complex had done so with nefarious motivations. If he were indeed the killer, he had seemingly kept Roxanne hostage before luring Michelle over by forcing Roxanne to claim that her car battery had died. As the investigation continued, a memorial service for Roxanne and Michelle was held at the Medford Congregational Church. It drew a crowd of almost 300 people, as the community came in droves to remember the two women. Mayor Jerry Losman received a standing ovation when he declared Medford a hate-free zone. Afterwards, he led a prayer to unmask the person or persons who are guilty of committing this terrible crime. The majority of the people in attendance wore lavender armbands and pink buttons that read, "Medford, hate-free zone." Yet beneath the united front, a somber cloud lingered, and discussions buzzed with speculation about the possible motives behind the tragic double murder. Among those grappling with the grim possibility of a hate crime was Brenda Brown, a close friend of the victims. She stated, "These were remarkable women who happened to be lesbian. They had remarkable lives that had nothing to do with their sexual orientation." The day after the service, the 12th of December, a phone call came into police from a woman named Darlene Bradshaw. She told detectives that she feared that her 27-year-old son, Robert Ackermond, was the suspect that they were looking for in the double murder. He looked remarkably similar to the composite sketch of the suspect, had been in Medford at the time, and drove a similar vehicle to the one described by the eyewitnesses. She commented, "I call police because I have to look God in the face. I will do anything in my power to make sure other people aren't hurt, but right now I know he's sick." Roxanne's pickup truck had been examined with a fine tooth comb, and they had found numerous unknown fingerprints on the duct tape binding her and Michelle. While Ackermond didn't have a criminal record, his fingerprints were on file with the Air Force, where he had spent 4 years. Detectives made contact with the Air Force, who provided them with his fingerprints. Astonishingly, Ackermond's fingerprints came back as a match to the fingerprints found inside the pickup truck. Detectives knew that they had their guy, but now they just needed to find him. They announced to the public that he was wanted in connection with Roxanne and Michelle's murder. They described him as a white man, standing at 5 feet 8 inches tall, weighing 150 pounds, with brown and grey hair and hazel eyes. District Attorney Mark Huddleston stated, "We hope to catch this guy and get him in custody in short order." The identification of a suspect in a timely fashion came as a welcome relief to all of Roxanne and Michelle's loved ones. Dan, Michelle's brother, commented, "We really appreciate the work the Medford Police Department has done in this case. The faith we had in them is being borne out so quickly." Detectives speculated that Ackermond might have been heading to California, which was where he was originally from. They dispatched 4 detectives south, but en route their attention was directed to Tulare. Shortly after Ackermond was publicly identified, he barged into the home of a family friend. Here, he found their 20-year-old daughter, Taryn Sweeney, who was home alone. He handcuffed her and demanded money. He was wanted in a double murder and needed to escape, he explained. As Taryn was handcuffed to the bed, one of her friends arrived, causing Ackermond to flee from the scene, while Taryn immediately called police. Not too long afterwards, detectives received a phone call from Ackermond's father, Kenneth. He told them that his son had paid him a visit in Stockton and that he was driving a U-Haul van. Detectives quickly descended on the area and they drove around all of the local motels until they spotted the U-Haul van in a Motel 6 parking lot. A police SWAT team descended on the motel and they surrounded it and evacuated the surrounding rooms. At about 4:20 a.m., a police negotiator telephoned the room where Ackermond was staying. He had made the booking under his real name. He was ordered to come out of the motel room with his arms raised. He responded and said he needed time to get dressed before he came out and surrendered. Ackermond was arrested without incident, and as soon as he was transported to the police headquarters, he began to talk. According to Ackermond, he never intended on killing Roxanne and Michelle. He said that he had wanted to rob their property management business and had envisioned that they would sign a check for him once he took them hostage. However, after he bound them and placed them in the back of Roxanne's pickup truck, he said that an urge overcame him to shoot them both dead, so that's what he did. He maintained that he wasn't motivated to kill Roxanne and Michelle because they were gay, before adding, "But that made it easier because I don't like them." Ackerman said to detectives that if they hadn't have found him at the motel, he would have killed others. He also chillingly commented, "I don't feel any remorse for these people. I didn't have the life I wanted. I didn't have the girl I wanted." All throughout the confession, Ackerman had a smile on his face, and as he went into gruesome detail, he began to chuckle. Following the confession, Ackerman's father, Kenneth, spoke with the San Francisco Examiner and said that his son knew what he had done and that he wanted to die. He then added, "He's confessed to killing the two women in Medford, Oregon. He said the papers have indicated the women were murdered because they were lesbians, and that's incorrect. He did it for money." After Ackerman had been arrested, he called his father from jail and maintained that he was not motivated to kill Roxanne and Michelle because of their sexual orientation.
"As soon as I got caught, I knew with all the evidence they got, any, we're fighting this one. It's over. Game done."
He told his father that he told Roxanne and Michelle that he was going to leave them tied up and not kill them.
"I just told them I was after the money and I was going to leave them both tied up, and in a day or two, then somebody would have found them there at the apartment."
Ackerman also had something else to reveal to his father. Roxanne and Michelle weren't his first victims. Back on the 3rd of October, 23-year-old Scott George had vanished in Visalia, California. Ackerman was the last person to have seen Scott alive, and before the murders of Roxanne and Michelle, he had been questioned by detectives 3 times. At the time, Ackerman denied having anything to do with Scott's disappearance, but when he was speaking to his father, he confessed that he had killed him. He said that he had shot Scott dead because money and girlfriend problems had been eating at him, and he had been drinking. He further commented that he had an urge just to want to kill him, and that he couldn't stop himself. On the night of the murder, Ackerman and Scott had been driving around after drinking in a local bar. Ackerman said that he pulled out his gun and shot Scott 4 times as he sat in the passenger seat. Kenneth had pleaded with his son to tell detectives what he had done with Scott's body, but he refused, saying that it would hurt somebody else. After the murder in Visalia, Ackerman had moved to Medford with his mother. He claimed that he had big plans to flee the country, and claimed to his father that he had hatched a plan to force Roxanne and Michelle to give him money from their real estate business. However, he claimed that everything started falling apart, and he resorted to killing them both. Kenneth commented, "I think he feels sorry. He knows that Oregon has the lethal injection, and he indicated to me that that's what he wants." At about that time, he started to cry. According to Kenneth, his son wasn't brought up that way. He then said, "Something happened to him, and he's cracked." As word of Ackerman's confession flooded the headlines, Roxanne and Michelle's loved ones were dubious. Lori commented, "I don't believe it. I still believe it was a hate crime. None of it makes sense." Ackerman's claims of a robbery gone wrong didn't fit with the crime scene either. He had left behind Roxanne and Michelle's purses, wallets, cash, credit cards, and cell phones. When Robert Ackerman was 5 years old, his parents went through a divorce, leading him to reside in California's Central Valley with his mother and brother, while his father remained an ever-present figure in his life. Throughout his upbringing, he consistently excelled in every endeavor he pursued. He played Little League baseball, mastered the trumpet, and maintained straight-A grades as a student. At the age of 17, he saw the Air Force as his path to success, and served as a medical materials specialist at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico. After receiving an honorable discharge in 1989, he pursued higher education. He earned a bachelor's degree before obtaining an MBA in business administration from Golden Gate University in San Francisco. As his father Kenneth said, if you had to put the title of a perfect kid on anyone, I could almost hang it on his neck. All I can say is I thought the world of him. Ackerman had vowed to be wealthy by the age of 27, and following his education, he joined Roadway Trucking in the Los Angeles area, working diligently for extended hours. However, he eventually decided to quit when he felt he wasn't progressing as successfully as he had envisioned. Driven by an intense desire for success and financial gain, he embarked on developing a computer system for the trucking industry, hoping that it would be his breakthrough. During a trip to Las Vegas, he fell deeply in love with an exotic dancer named Ala Kosova. He was her best customer, often spending around $3,000 a weekend with her at the strip club. He even gifted her two pairs of diamond earrings and took her to the movies and out to dinner. Ala saw Ackerman as nothing more than a good customer, but he was obsessed. He continued traveling to Las Vegas, reveling in the excitement, residing in casinos and gambling away whatever money he had managed to save over the years. However, the computer system didn't yield the anticipated profits, and Ackerman quickly began running out of money. He used up his retirement fund and maxed out his credit cards, running up a bill of $97,000. He claimed to Ala that somebody in New York had stolen all of his money, and she eventually cut off all ties with him. She recollected, "My relationship with him was based on a financial basis. I just changed my number." Ackerman was forced to return to his mother's home in Visalia, where he fell into a state of disrepair. He became a heavy drinker, and when he drank, he got angry. He began reading up on guns, bombs, surveillance techniques, and even how to manufacture drugs such as methamphetamine. He needed a way to get money so that he could go back to Las Vegas and win over Ala. He considered robbing and killing a truck driver that his mother was dating, as well as a friend of his mother's, to raise enough money to rekindle what he thought was a broken relationship. Ultimately, he decided against it, and in November of 1995, he and his mother moved to Medford. His brother, Kenneth Jr., and his brother's wife were already living there, running the Tiki Lodge Motel. Ackerman and his mother, Darlene, were looking for an apartment to rent, which was when he crossed paths for the first time with Roxanne and Michelle. After seeing their business advertised, they reached out to the couple in order to find a rental apartment. Roxanne showed them around some apartments in the area, but they ended up renting from somebody else. However, Ackerman couldn't get Roxanne and Michelle out of his mind and began plotting something ominous. On the 16th of December, Ackerman agreed to be extradited back to Oregon and was informed that the process would take place within 2 weeks. Before the extradition, he consented to a jailhouse interview with the San Francisco Examiner. Throughout the interview, Ackerman maintained that his motive for killing Roxanne and Michelle was not because of their sexual orientation. However, he then expressed, "I don't care for lesbians. I couldn't help but think that she's 54 years old and have been dating that woman for 12 years. Isn't that sick? That's someone's grandma, for God's sake. Could you imagine my grandma, a lesbian with another woman? It crossed my mind a couple of times. Lesbo grandma, what a thing." He said that he made an exception for bisexual women, stating that they were acceptable. He once again stated that he initially intended to rob them, but was then overcome by an overwhelming urge to shoot them, describing it as part of the American way. Reflecting on the moment, he stated, "All of a sudden I just looked down and had that feeling. It was definitely an urge. I didn't even think about it, not even for a moment." When asked about the experience of killing somebody, he responded, "It's not a like feeling. It's maybe a little relieving. It's interesting. It's no different than shooting your chicken that just lost in a cockfight, or putting your sick dog to sleep, or shooting at tin cans." He confessed again to killing his friend Scott, claiming that Scott hadn't done anything to provoke him. He stated, "I had my gun on the right side of the seat. I just picked it up and shot him in the back of his head." With a hint of amusement, he recounted making a silencer for his gun, possibly indicating a subconscious desire to test it out. He then remembered. The next day, I was regretting having to clean up and dispose of him. Ackermund attributed the three murders to his frustration at not achieving his life's goal of being happy, which he associated with being wealthy. He expressed disappointment in obtaining a business degree, stating, "There are too many business grads out there. If I had chosen another field, all of this may not have happened." He also spoke about his descent into darkness after struggling to find a job and losing Alla. In a composed manner, he shared, "I'd always wondered what I would do to get money if I ever got into a bind. As long as I owned a gun, there was my insurance policy. But even if I didn't have it, I could still kill. There are other means." Ackermund also voiced his desire to be sentenced to death, before cryptically adding, "You have to know something about pathology, something about signatures. The definition of a mass murder is more than two murders as part of the same act. Was that an act? That's the big question." Following the interview, Ackermund spoke with his father, Kenneth, on the phone. He told his father what he had done with Scott's body, revealing for the first time that he had dumped him at the bottom of a mine shaft on his father's property.
"Because I never told them about the intent to kill him. See, the perfect murder has no bodies, no evidence. That got all fouled up because Michelle told a co-worker where she was going. So that's why I left the bodies. Otherwise, they'd be down that mine shaft with that other guy down there stalking."
Kenneth immediately informed detectives who arrived at his home promptly. There, at the bottom of the mine shaft, they found the lifeless and decomposed body of Scott George. He had died exactly how Ackermund had claimed, by gunshot wounds. On the 20th of December, a Jackson County grand jury handed down indictments charging Ackermund with aggravated murder in the case of Roxanne and Michelle. Prosecutor John Bondurant said that he was still deciding on whether he would be seeking the death penalty if Ackermund was convicted. The following day, Sheriff Bob Kenny found himself grappling with a challenging task, halting Ackermund's jailhouse interviews. Ackermund, who harboured a sense of entitlement, expressed dismay at not being showcased and denied access to every reporter seeking an interview. However, just a day later, Ackermund shocked the public with a sinister announcement, proclaiming that he harboured a dark secret, one that he was willing to sell to the highest bidder. Amidst Ackermund's desperate attempt to capitalize on his crimes, a touching response emerged from Roxanne and Michelle's loved ones. They embarked on a heartfelt initiative to raise funds for a new community centre dedicated to the gay community in honour of the slain women. Symbolic t-shirts, featuring a heart emblazoned on the breast with the poignant words, "Honor Love," became tokens of remembrance and hope. All proceeds would contribute to the new centre, which would be aptly named after Roxanne and Michelle. Ultimately, the centre opened and was called the Abdul Ellis Lambada Community Centre, and it was located in Ashland and served as a sanctuary for the LGBTQ+ community. While waiting for the case to proceed in jail, Ackermund received a visit from his father, Kenneth, who sought to unravel the complex puzzle of his son's murderous path. In a heart-wrenching exchange, Kenneth probed as to whether he had done anything in his life to cause his son to be this way. Ackermund said that he accepted responsibility and he refrained from deflecting blame elsewhere. Then on the 25th of January, Ackermund shuffled into court with leg irons and green jail fatigues. He pleaded not guilty to the murders of Roxanne and Michelle. The prosecution announced that they were seeking the death penalty against him, and his defence attorney, Ralph Monson, filed a motion to overturn this, as well as mandatory sentencing. He said he believed that the 1984 initiative that restored the death penalty and the 1994 initiative that stiffened mandatory sentences for violent crimes were both unconstitutional. In a shocking revelation in August, Ackermund finally revealed the secret that he had been guarding since his arrest. He disclosed to the Stockton Record that the murders of Roxanne and Michelle were in fact motivated by a deep-rooted homophobia. He confessed to fabricating the robbery motive, out of fear for retribution from other inmates. With a chilling indifference, Ackerman declared, "Now I just don't care what people think, including the jury." He then said, "I've known bisexual women, and that's cool. I have no problem with that. I have no compassion for lesbians, or bisexual or gay men. I can't deal with it." According to Ackerman, he was also motivated to kill Scott for the same reason, claiming that he had made a pass at him. Ackerman also made the startling claim that his father had sexually abused him as a child, something that Kenneth staunchly denied. Kenneth said he believed his son had made up the claim of sexual abuse because he was angry that he hadn't passed on some personal items to his brother following his arrest. Kenneth also said that the day his son made the claims, he had threatened him during a phone call. Ackerman had come to learn that his father was the one who told detectives that he was driving a U-Haul van shortly before his arrest. On the phone call, Ackerman had threatened that if he could get out of jail, he would put a bullet in his father's head. On the 12th of September, Ackerman returned to the courtroom, surprising all by altering his plea to guilty for the murders of Roxanne and Michelle. Throughout the proceedings, an unsettling smile splayed across his face, exuding an air of defiance. Prosecutor John Bondurant recounted the chilling events of December 4th, describing how Ackerman bound Roxanne with duct tape while showing him an apartment. Desperate for money, Ackerman attempted to coerce Roxanne into writing him a check, resorting to even more sinister measures when she refused. He compelled Roxanne to lure Michelle to the scene, but both women stood resolute, refusing his demands. In a callous act of violence, Ackerman forced them into the back of their pickup truck, where he fatally shot them. Fleeing with their bodies, he remained uncertain if they were truly dead, stopping again to deliver fatal shots before abandoning the vehicle at an apartment complex. A chilling array of evidence connected him to the murders. His fingerprints had been found on the duct tape, in the apartment, and on the pickup truck. Furthermore, traces of Roxanne and Michelle's blood adorned the barrel of his pistol. Prosecutors announced that they were still seeking the death penalty despite the guilty plea. Ackerman was then asked whether he had anything to say, and he responded, "Nope, nothing to say." The courtroom was packed with all of the couple's loved ones, and every now and then Ackerman stared directly at Roxanne's daughter, Lori. Outside of court, she said that it was evil that he kept staring at her, before adding, "He'll meet his maker, and that will be the end of it." In December, defense attorney Ralph Monson filed a motion to withdraw the guilty pleas. According to Ackerman, he wanted to get a first-hand look at prison before making a final decision on whether to seek execution. The judge, however, denied his request. And in September of 1997, Ackerman went on trial to learn his fate. It would be up to the jury to decide whether he should die or get life in prison. Ackerman had shared his desire to be executed by lethal injection, but his defense team were seeking a sentence of life in prison. During the opening statements, Prosecutor John Bondurant revealed to the jury that Ackerman had provided a full and detailed confession to the two murders, which would be presented to them in a videotaped form. Throughout the confession, Ackerman could be seen laughing, a disturbing display of callousness. In contrast, the defense team urged the jury to consider a life imprisonment sentence for Ackerman instead of the death penalty. They claimed that Ackerman's actions were driven by self-destructive impulses, and his laughter during the confession was an attempt to secure a death sentence. Evidence was then revealed to the jury, including a stun gun that had been recovered from the motel where Ackerman was arrested. He had used this to stun Roxanne and Michelle before binding them, telling detectives that it must have hurt like hell. In the motel room, detectives also came across books, including one written by an FBI agent, about tracking down serial killers. He had underlined several passages, and detectives strongly believed that if he were not apprehended, he would have killed more people. After all, he had told them, "If you want to know what I'm all about, Look at that serial killer book. Ackerman's father, Kenneth, testified during the trial, telling the jury about the threats his son had made to put a bullet in his head. As he spoke, Ackerman glanced up, only occasionally, but Kenneth refused to look at his son. He said that when his son was younger, he had given him a family heirloom, a diamond ring. After the murders, Ackerman had left the ring at his father's home. Kenneth testified, "When I seen the ring, knowing what I heard from police, I thought it was goodbye. The end. It was like, here, Dad, I love you, goodbye." Kenneth also revealed that after his son claimed he had sexually abused him, he wrote a letter apologising for what he had said and what he had done. Testimony was also presented regarding the murder of Scott George. Ackerman was questioned in relation to Scott's murder. The detective suggested that Scott was bisexual and said to Ackerman, "I think you got sexual issues that pushed you over the edge." Even though Ackerman had told his father that he killed Scott because he made a pass at him, during the interview with detectives, he denied that he knew that Scott was bisexual and claimed he just wanted to kill him. Ala Kosova, the exotic dancer from Las Vegas, was also called as a prosecution witness. While Ackerman had often referred to her as his girlfriend, she said she simply saw their relationship as a financial transaction. He was one of her customers and he liked to spoil her. She said that they never had sex, and there was no romantic basis to their relationship. She said that after the murders of Roxanne and Michelle, Ackerman had sold his Thunderbird for $5,000 and came to see her in Las Vegas. One night he pulled out a gun and stun gun and said that he had killed three people. She testified, "He unscrewed the silencer on the gun and said, 'See, there's still blood in there.'" She feared that he was going to kill her as well, and she testified, "I told him I loved him, and he believed me." The defense called their own witnesses in an effort to save Ackerman's life. Former colleagues testified that he was a hard worker, with Ralph Santelli of Roadway Express Trucking stating, "I think what impressed me most was he had accomplished much at a young age." His friends from high school and college also testified, painting him as an ambitious man who wanted to succeed. As Ryan Morris said, "He was one of the best out of all of us. We were the wild ones, and he was the smart one." Ackerman's brother, Kenneth Jr., also testified. Through tears, he said he didn't want to see his brother die. He said that he had always looked up to his brother, telling the jury, "He was always pretty much so intelligent that I couldn't hold a conversation with him." Psychologist Craig Daney told the courtroom that in the months leading up to the murders, Ackerman had become obsessed with Ala. He stated, "He's waking up in the middle of the night crying because he can't come and see her. He realizes now she only cared for him for financial reasons." He said that Ackerman was in a hopeless situation, economically and emotionally, and knew he wouldn't have a relationship with Ala unless he had money. According to Haney, Ackerman's obsession was part of a descent into chaos, triggered by his failure in both business and love. Ackerman was given the opportunity to testify, but he turned down the offer. The jury were then sent off to deliberate, and it took them just 4 hours to reach a decision. They sentenced Robert Ackerman to death. As the verdict was announced, he showed no emotion. Outside of court, District Attorney Mark Huddleston said that he was pleased with the verdict, adding, "I always felt that if the death penalty was not appropriate for somebody like Robert Ackerman, I don't know who it would be appropriate for." Lori also said that she was pleased, but said that the verdict wouldn't bring her mother or Michelle back home. Ackerman was escorted out of the courtroom to begin his new life on death row, but it wouldn't be long before he was back in court once more. In May of 1990, Ackerman was charged with the murder of Scott George and was extradited to California to stand trial. In August of 2001, the case was pushed back after his defense attorney, Jim Cordell, asked to be removed from the case. Ackerman had threatened to kill him and his family. The murder trial began in August of 2002, and it was revealed that after Ackerman had shot Scott in the car, He wasn't dead. Ackerman drove around before pulling into an orchard, where he shot Scott twice in the head, and then two more times in the chest. Ackerman then got a tarp from his mother's home to cover Scott's body, and then drove to Stockton to dispose of him. Once more, Ackerman was convicted of murder. During the penalty phase, his father, Kenneth, urged for his son to be sentenced to death. Through tears, he said, "I've never told you how deeply you've hurt your brother, your mother and I." He said that all of the dreams and hopes he had for his son had been shattered. He then added, "All I can think about is the right you took away from the people you killed. Your mother had a dagger stabbed in her heart when she found out. She lost her job, her car, her house, most of all, her firstborn son." Scott George's father, Art, also lamented on the impact his son's murder had. He said that in his life, all he ever wanted was a family to grow old with. Scott's sister, Wendy, said, "Scott will never have the chance to see my girls grow up. I will never have the chance to have my own nieces and nephews." Once more, Robert Ackerman was sentenced to death. In 2011, Ackerman's death sentence was reduced to life in prison after he was diagnosed as delusional and unable to assist in his own appeals. Federal law bans the execution of inmates who are not sufficiently competent. 7 years later, 50-year-old Robert Ackerman was found dead in his cell in the Oregon State Penitentiary. His cause of death was natural causes, although he had attempted suicide numerous times throughout his incarceration. United in love and a fervent commitment to gay rights, Roxanne Ellis and Michelle Abdul had forged an unbreakable bond, becoming vocal champions of the movement. Seeking refuge from the shadows of intolerance in Colorado, they believed that Medford would be their safe sanctuary, a place where acceptance would reign. Little did they know that even in the most seemingly welcome communities, the seeds of hatred could take root. Their lives were tragically cut short, leaving behind a profound legacy that endured through the Abdul Ellis Lambada Community Centre. Though the centre met an untimely closure in 2010, their spirit lives on in the hearts of those who carry their torch, continuing the fight for gay rights with unwavering determination. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Holly. As you all know, Morbidology is a one-woman podcast, so the support up on Patreon seriously goes such a long way, and I am eternally grateful. In exchange for your support, I upload ad-free and early release episodes, bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, behind the scenes, which includes bonus audio, case files, and videos, and I also send out some merch and a handwritten thank you card. If you'd like to support the show in another way, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you're listening. It's an easy way to support a show that you like, and I genuinely do appreciate the feedback. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.